This is my last talk at the Village, and I'm feeling sort of extroverted and flamboyant and wanting to do something sort of crazy, and I'm hoping it works. There's a way of seeing things that's kind of different from the way we normally see things. And I just keep hearing more and more and more about this in all different ways, in all different places where I'm looking and different fields that I study or reading I do. And it comes so that you talk to people, and even if they haven't put a name or a label on the way they're thinking differently, they'll say, you know, I've been thinking about this, and it seems to me it's more this than this. And you'll realize, aha, yep, that fits into this pattern. There's a kind of a funny pattern that seems to be emerging of thinking about things in a little different way. And I'd like to talk about that pattern today. I'd like to read a statement that gives you some feeling for a motivation for why one would like to do that kind of thing. The words I've chosen are not my words, actually. They're the words of a research team. And they're not meant to scare you. They're meant to be fun. They're meant to be sort of playful. And I hope, even though they look intimidating at this point, by the time we're done, I think you'll have a feel for how the way of thinking about things on one column is a little different from the way on the other column. And really, it's not necessarily that one way is any easier or harder than the other way. It's just that it's different. And I'd like to talk about and try to appreciate those differences. Do any of you know Thomas Berry, the theologian of the school of thought of Matthew Fox? You all know Matthew Fox? No, a few of you know Matthew Fox, creation theologian. Thomas Berry has said, it's all a question of story. We're in trouble just now because we do not have a good story. We are in between stories. The old story, the account of how the world came to be and how we fit into it, is not functioning properly, and we have not learned the new story. The old story sustained us for a long period of time. It shaped our emotional attitudes, provided us with life purpose, energized action. It consecrated suffering, integrated knowledge, guided education. We awoke in the morning and we knew where we were. We could answer the questions of our children. We could identify crime, punish criminals. Everything was taken care of because the story was there. It did not make people good. It did not take away the pains and the stupidities of life or make for unfailing warmth in human association. But it did provide a context in which life could function in a meaningful manner. If that rings true for you at all, and if you feel like you're looking around or groping for either a new story or at least a reinterpretation or re-understanding of some aspects of our old story, that seems to me to characterize these times, and maybe you'll find some resonance with the kinds of things I'll be talking about today. In an attempt to come to grips with a new story and look at what's going on in the way of changing of stories, a group of people at, of all places, Stanford Research Institute, SRI International, sponsored an investigation of trends in philosophical thought and in theoretical considerations in a whole variety of different fields, just sort of looking across the spectrum of academic disciplines and professional activities, to ask the question at that level, what's going on? What kinds of questions are being asked? What are the issues? And of course, they found all kinds of complex topics being talked about. I mean, each field has its own specialization and issues that are current and hot topics now. But then they tried to strip away all the jargon of the field that was specific to that field and see, can we make any general conclusions about the kinds of questions that are coming up at the frontiers in all these different fields. They considered, let's see, the list is long, physics, chemistry, mathematics, ecology, evolution, psychology, brain theory, consciousness theory, linguistics, philosophy, religion, politics, and the arts. I think they probably left out a few, but I'm not sure what they are. business, okay. And when they got done, they took all that stuff. This was like a 5-year research project that they did. It was very costly. I'm not sure quite who sponsored it. But I do know that they were selling the results of this theory for $2,000 to non-subscribers. And so I haven't ever seen their final publication of the work. I've just heard a talk given by the people who did this research, and was very impressed with the categories they came up with, because it seemed to me a useful structure for organizing a lot of the things that I saw that was going on too. So I'm going to try and deal with the structures they came up with. They recognized 7 patterns. They boil it down to 7, finally. Recognizing a shift in the way people in all these different areas seem to be thinking about their particular field and the questions in their field. You can't really say they're old patterns and new patterns. Sometimes the new patterns are very old. Sometimes they have been done, or they've been a process throughout history. The new way of thinking about things has always been there, but what it is that in these times, new attention is being directed to some of these sometimes very ancient patterns, ancient ways of doing things. And it's not that the new way is any better than the old way. It's that the new ideas are sort of balancing or enriching the perspective. In some particular fields, I know, for example, in physics, sometimes the old way was so firmly embedded in the way of thinking that it was thought to be the only way. It wasn't even seen as a way of thinking. It was thought that this is the only way one can think, and so you don't even recognize that you're making any assumptions about how you're dealing with things. Maybe each of you in your own area of interest can see either that the field has gone that way, or that you know people in your area that have kind of looked at the world that way, that they don't even realize the way they look at the world is a particular personal perspective. They think it's the only way to look at the world. How else could one look at the world? So here are the 7 categories they came up with, and I'd like to talk a little bit about each one of them and make these words that are probably pretty meaningless right now take on some life for you. The first area is the best one to start with: intrinsic complexity and diversity, as opposed to simplicity. We're always looking for simple solutions. It's really comforting when you can boil everything down to something and you can say, aha, here's the essence of it all, and here's the answer, or here's the one statement that we can say that characterizes reality about this. And now it's just a matter of, you know, getting that information out. Well, or in the case of theories in various fields, if you can arrive at one nice, neat equation and say, aha, this characterizes the universe, this equation is the key to everything, it looks like things aren't going that way. It looks like the world can't be reduced to simple, simplistic, probabilistic rules. The world seems to be intrinsically, at its very nature, complex and diverse. And no matter how much we try to simplify and unify, there's limits to how well we can do that. Plurality, somebody said, a quote that you've probably heard me say before if you've heard any of my other talks, it's just struck me recently, the world is incorrigibly plural. No matter what we do about it, it's incorrigibly plural. There are basic limits to reductionism, which attempts to understand complex wholes by examining the parts, and especially when the parts interact strongly or non-linearly, when something produces an effect over here and then this thing produces an effect back on this, you get all kinds of strange behaviors that are unpredictable on the basis of some kind of simple theory or simple mathematics. Mathematicians are developing what's called a theory of complex systems. It's been around for like 30 years. There's a lot of work in that area. von Bertalanffy is a name that's associated with that. He's done a lot of work in complex systems theory. Elementary particle physicists keep finding more elementary particles. And so even the word elementary starts seeming to be sort of ridiculous. It used to be, you know, three protons, neutrons, and electrons. In fact, it used to be just atoms. That was kind of simple. There were 90 kinds of those. And they said, aha, all 90 of those can be made up of protons, neutrons, and electrons. 90-some. 100-and-some, actually, when they start making more. But anyway. So we got it all boiled down to three, and everybody was pretty happy. And then pretty soon they started finding more and more and more and more. And now we're up to 120-some, and then plus the antiparticles that go along with those particles. And they keep needing to postulate more kinds. So they tried to simplify it again. They said, okay, looks like all these elementary particles can be built up of quarks. Have you ever heard of quarks? Uh-huh. That's the big thing in physics for the past about 10 years. So they started putting these quarks together, and it started out really neat. They only needed three quarks and three antiquarks, six. And then pretty soon they started needing different variations on this kind of quark and this kind of quark and this kind of quark. They started attributing flavors to them and colors and various other characteristics. So pretty soon they're up to now at least 15, 30, when you take the antiquarks, 30 types of quarks to put together to try and make up these 100 and some elementary particles. And that theory itself has become, you know, extremely complex again. You know, maybe they'll come up with another one that says, aha, there's only three kinds of subquarks necessary to make up the quarks or something. But that's, we always seem to be running into limits as to how well we can reduce our knowledge to simple, basic principles. The Ten Commandments was real comforting. You know, we've got 10 of them. That's all there are, just 1 to 10. And it's very neat. Or in fact, Jesus even reduced it down to 2, love God and love your neighbor. I guess that was done in Deuteronomy too, but Jesus reaffirmed that. It's real nice and simple. But then you start saying, okay, what does it mean to love God? What does it mean to love your neighbor? And you start realizing, it gets pretty involved. A situation makes a difference. It's nice to have simplicity, but simplicity by itself is not very informative. As soon as you start asking what your simplicity really means, the implications of that simplicity, things become very diverse and complex very quickly. Theologians, social anthropologists recognize the limits of the process of demythologizing. It was a big move back in the 30s or so. Barth and Bultmann, some of the theologians, trying to say we've alienated a lot of people with our Christianity because we've got all these stories. Let's get down to the basic essence of what our stories have to say. What is the true message, the true meaning of Jesus and of the crucifixion and resurrection? And so they tried to strip away all the story and look at the essential meaning and hoped that they would be able to find perhaps some connection with other religions, other religious traditions, and they did. It was somewhat successful. But you finally strip away story, 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 and try to get an essence, and you're left with some statement like, God loves you. And that's fine, that's real nice. But, and it's good to do that maybe, but the story itself becomes part of the richness of your heritage. And to attach a very specific meaning to it, and to say that's all it means, to try to say this is the essence of the story, is to lose sight of the richness of the myth. Scott Hasserud in The Village last week is a Jungian psychologist and was talking about interpretation of dreams. He would say, once you've taken a dream and analyzed it and said, aha, here's what this dream means, you've taken what was a very rich symbolic package, a myth, and you've reduced it down to some essential sign. And he says, to reduce a symbol, a rich symbol, to a sign is to lose the richness of that symbol and to basically destroy the meaning. Truth, then, is the weave, not the thread. It's the complex interaction of all the things that gives rise to the truth, not just the threads themselves. In the socioeconomic domain, there are limits to the efficiencies of simple homogenization, standardization, and centralization. There are real needs for diversity, for pluralism, and for decentralization. One of my concerns about putting the churches together into one nice Lutheran church, NLC, nice Lutheran church, is that we'll lose the diversity. It's nice to have the efficiencies that you gain by not having competing hierarchies and having all this pluralism, but when you lose that diversity, it seems like there is some real loss there. It's nice to have the redundancy is useful. Okay, that's kind of what I mean by that. You can maybe think of examples in your own life where you run up against the limits of reductionism or of trying to make things simple, and then finally you just have to say, there's something beautiful about this rich, incredibly rich creation that we've been given. So revel in it. Revel in the diversity of humanity. Don't try to make everybody the same. Don't expect that they all be the same. Don't expect that everybody believe the same. God made us plural, and sure, God is trying to bring us together in harmony, but that harmony doesn't mean uniformity. It doesn't mean monotone. It means the rich number of voices. Heterarchy. If I spend this long on every one, we're not going to get through seven, so I better hustle along here. Heterarchy is a strange word that I hadn't heard of before at this point, but it's kind of useful. It's the opposite, or one of the opposites, of hierarchy. Hierarchy, we all know, the idea of top-down order and of this dependent upon this, dependent upon this, and the orders come from the top, sort of. Heterarchy is the idea that's involved in networks, where you have power centers spread out horizontally, and there's communication horizontally. There's no top, there's no pinnacle or peak, no first thing. We compulsively order things in our lives and in society. There's always has to be a first or a last, or a best and a worst, or a highest and a lowest. It's really fun sometimes to take your hierarchies and try to somehow neutralize them, bring them down so they're horizontal, and so that they're all laying out there in front of you. Life is not always arrayed neatly into hierarchies or spectrums. You don't always have things going from here to here. Some things just kind of exist in a free-flowing network. If you've ever tried to write a coherent paper or give a coherent talk, you know how you've got all these ideas in your mind, and they're sort of one idea is here, and one idea is here, and ideas here, and ideas here, and they all connect to each other, and yet you're supposed to somehow pick one and say, this is what I'm going to say first, pick another one, this is what I'm going to say second, because it follows, third, fourth, and arrange them in some kind of a linear order. It's really hard to do, because our minds instinctively don't work that way. Our minds grapple with things and see connections that make sort of a network much more than a hierarchy of ideas. Some examples. A pecking order in which an elephant fears the mouse. It's a heterarchy. The elephant is bigger than this, is bigger than this, is bigger than this, but then you get down to the mouse and the elephant is afraid of the mouse. When you try to answer a question, who is stronger, the United States or the Soviet Union? Okay, stronger. It seems to be a compulsive question that we have to ask. You know, are we superior to them? Are we equals? Are we what? And yet, think of all the different criteria you could use for establishing strength. I mean, do you mean numbers of missiles? Do you mean the quality of the spirituality of the people? Do you mean how hard the people are willing to work? Do you mean how many resources you have behind you? Do you mean, you know, all these elements, and I could name dozens more, come into relative comparisons between nations or between people. And at some point, it's valuable to stop trying compulsively to order things and put something over something else. The feminist writers have been very good in calling our attention to the sense in which we tend to hierarchically arrange everything. They pointed out, for example, that in male-male conversations, very quickly, one of the two men will try to establish, they'll play this kind of a game as to see who's kind of in the superior position. And usually it doesn't go too far before one man recognizes that the other is one up. And so is willing, usually, to drop down to the one down position and have sort of a deferential attitude toward the other male. But males, what the feminists are saying is that the males can't even talk to each other without establishing pretty quickly in their conversation who's actually going to take the superior position, who's going to have the inferior position. And once they've established that, the conversation goes just fine. But this relationship of one up or one down has to be sort of agreed upon. And if they can't get that, if there's constant tension on that, they'll just quit talking to each other. The relationship breaks. Well, women will come into relationships and seek to bring each other equal. If you come into a relationship and you feel a little bit superior to somebody because of what, education, or because more knowledge on a certain subject or something, they'll seek to bring the other person up so that they can talk to an equal. They're constantly working against the one-up point of view. And so this study that this was based on was saying, you know, that when a woman then talks to a man, very often the man will be looking for, is she going to be one up to me or is she going to be one down to me? And the woman is trying desperately to get the man to stand beside her. And so there's tension that maybe you've seen that pattern in your life. I've seen it in mine sometimes. So hierarchies can be important. The recent importance given to social concepts such as decentralization or networking. There's a whole big book called Networking now that's based on helping people realize the power that's inherent in networking. NGOs, non-governmental organizations, that nations don't have to relate to each other only by virtue of their governments, which is sort of the top of the hierarchical pyramid. There's all kinds of relations that can go on at the lower level. You can have exchange programs with Soviet citizens coming to the United States and our citizens going to the Soviet Union. You can have letter exchanges at the grassroots levels. All communication doesn't have to come through by the top. Grassroots organizations in general all attest to the usefulness of the concept of hierarchy. Morphogenesis. It's one of the ones that kind of, that was another new word for me. The word, but it just really rang true for things I had been thinking about. The word morphogenesis is out of Greek roots. Morphos is form, genesis is birth. So it's a birth of form. And the concept is that there are a lot of things in life that grow up where the form evolves out of a process that is very unpredictable, that is not deterministic, that comes about sort of spontaneously. The opposite of morphogenesis, it's contrasted with mechanical change or sort of a blueprint method of doing something. If you want to build a building and you start out with a plan, you've got the blueprint, you've got the building all planned in your mind, you've got the end goal in sight, and you go about building it in some kind of systematic way, you get the building there. What if instead you built the building by saying, anybody who wants to come and work over here, just bring your hammer and nails and we'll build a building, okay? And people would just come in and they'd see, well, it looks like we need a board there. So they'd put a board there and somebody else would come in, it looks like we need a board over here. They put a board over there. There's no blueprint, no plan. You'd wind up with a building probably, but it'd really be bizarre. And the form would have been sort of an evolved, interactive form that depended upon the visions that each particular person brought into that co-creative process. It turns out there's a lot of things in life that work morphogenically rather than deterministically or mechanically or blueprint-wise. In science, they needed theories of morphogenesis to explain certain odd things that happen, life being one of those odd things. According to the laws of thermodynamics, it seemed as though the world, the universe, should be sort of running downhill, dissipating energy and kind of evolving downward. And yet here is life sort of in defiance of this general increase of entropy or increase of disorder. Things should have become more random, less highly organized, and yet here comes human beings standing in sort of defiance of that general rundownness that the universe is supposed to have. How can that happen? Well, there's, you know, comfortable for a Christian perhaps to say, oh, well, God's doing it, and write it off. You know, anything you don't understand, you can just blame it on God. Bonhoeffer warned us some years ago about that God, that he called it the God of the gaps. The gaps in your knowledge, anything you don't understand, you just blame on God. But unfortunately, the scientists keep filling in the gaps and saying, aha, we do understand how the grass comes up now. We do understand why the rain falls. We do understand this and this and this. And so for people for whom the God of the gaps was their only God, those gaps just keep getting sort of eroded away, and they're left, you know, wondering where God is and kind of desperately clinging to the last few little gaps in their knowledge so that they can say, aha, God is still there somewhere. Well, you know, God is obviously so much more than just the one who explains all those things that we can't explain. God can also be involved in all the things that we do understand as well as the things that we don't understand. God is not just the God of mystery. God is the God of hardcore reality, too. That's getting off into a sermon there. Let's come back to what I'm trying to talk about. The scientists were baffled for a long time by life processes, and they saw them as being different from physical processes. Until about 10 to 15 years ago, when theories of morphogenesis were developed, and it was seen that there are all kinds of places in nature, actually, where processes tend to evolve in complexity rather than devolve, rather than dissipate or break down. When you have an evolution of a galaxy, for example, you start out with a big mass of dust and gases, uniform, dissipated, just out there, kind of swirling around in an amorphous, formless, morphogenesis. Amorphous means without form, okay? That's the same root as morphogenesis. If something, it has no form, it's just these gases out there. And then gravity is acting on them. They start coming together. They start getting hotter. They start radiating energy. Little by little, they start coalescing into stars. Because where you have a local anomaly, a local disturbance, a little whirlpool or vortex, it tends to amplify itself as this stuff collapses. And this amplification process, you get stars condensing. And pretty soon you've got spiral arms, and you've got a big center like we have in our galaxy, maybe a black hole there, pulling things in even more. And pretty soon within these little solar systems now that you have created, there can be planets developing, and you can have conditions ripe for life to evolve on a planet. Turns out that these processes are not anti-physical, they're not mysterious, you can predict that they have to occur. They can't not occur. That this differentiation process, or the evolution in complexity, the ordering of matter, will inevitably come about through the natural workings of the laws of physics, the laws of nature. To me, that's exciting. That doesn't put God out for me. That puts God right in the heart of things. For somebody who doesn't believe in God, you know, I guess it doesn't help them much. But I feel like, you know, that gives God, that is such an awesome process to me that it really invokes God in a very real way. So the main work there in that area of what's called the theory of dissipative structures, and it doesn't mean dissipating energy, it means dissipating entropy, dissipating disorder, and actually accumulating order. That theory was developed especially by Ilya Prigogine, one of the Nobel Prize winners in chemistry a few years back, and Fritz Zwicky, See, it deals with any highly organized complex systems such as galaxies or organisms or societies. From totally chaotic and disorganized cosmic soup, we get order. The theories would indicate that social change, especially in periods of great stress, is more likely to be unpredictably morphogenic than mechanical. You're more likely to get a little fluctuation which amplifies itself into order rather than things just merely evolving according to blueprint. When you've got a system under stress, or when you've got a system that's experiencing this kind of evolutionary process, one little small change in it can amplify into something large. Another example is whirlpools. You've got a stream flowing, and you've got right behind a rock, you've got a big whirlpool. It turns out that those are very stable structures as long as the flow of the stream continues. But if you change the flow of the stream, let's say you make a little bit more water flow down through there, sometimes very abruptly you can change the whirlpool pattern. Instead of a whirlpool here, all of a sudden it'll shift and go over here. This one will break down very quickly, and another one will appear over in another area. It's kind of it's called a threshold effect. There are certain physical processes and certain biological processes where these threshold effects are really, really interesting. And they only occur in complex systems. You don't get them in simple systems. Complex systems meaning one where a lot of things are interacting very strongly. That metaphor then, or that image, becomes a useful one for people that are talking about social change and looking for the possibilities of being catalysts in a process that can allow social change to occur fast enough to save us from things like nuclear disaster. I mean, we've had an evolution over thousands of years of our techniques of warfare to the point where now we all see it's absurd. Most of us see it's absurd. And yet, how do we get out of that track? Is there an inevitable marching onward? Are we going to have ever bigger and better bombs? Do we have to have Star Wars and then the thing beyond Star Wars, and the bombs have to constantly get bigger and bigger and bigger? That would be the mechanical change model. Or can something like a peace movement, which starts out really small and is a little prick in the side of the great institution of war, can that possibly become amplified through the stresses in the system to become a new way of social organization so that we could have peace among nations, or perhaps not even have nations, but have peace among peoples in the world, different peoples?
And you said that the psychologists
also felt this. Yes. So that they were able to say that in human beings, across that under stress,
rather than being more rigid, they might be more flexible.
That's there. It usually comes as a breakthrough. It's like the Gestalt therapists you can kind of nudge a person here, nudge them there, and you won't see any change on the outside, and then all of a sudden there'll be sort of a conversion experience or a release, and people will can go into just sort of shift modes. I mean, you probably have examples of that that you could cite from.
Oh, that's encouraging.
Examples of less desirable morphogenesis include the development of mental illness or international conflict through vicious circles which amplify what may have been an accidental or insignificant trigger. You could get, you know, a nuclear war out of one malfunctioning transistor. It's just, and that could happen anywhere. The little trigger is not the problem. The problem is the system that amplifies that trigger rather than feeding back, doing negative feedback and damping out those little perturbations, those little mistakes. You've got to have feedback to damp out. Let me read my statement here. Morphogenesis suggests focusing remedial attention on the pathological feedback structures more so than on the multitude of possible triggers. There's all kinds of things that can set you off in the wrong direction, but don't amplify those things. De-amplify them or damp them. when Jesus says, love your enemy, you know, that to me means it's not a matter of, that's a way of changing that feedback structure, I think. If you love your enemy, then the escalation of conflict doesn't occur the same way. Sure, your enemy can hurt you, but if you're willing to absorb that and say, stop, but I'm not going to hit you back, that feedback structure changes. When my kids fight, I've been trying to get them to see that, if you tolerate a bit of abuse from the other person, tell them it's abuse, tell them you don't like it, but tolerate it, and don't take an eye for an eye. You don't have to hit back. That hitting back is not, you know, who hit first is not the point. The point is it takes two people to make the fight and to escalate it to the point where it's a major fight. One person can't escalate, or typically won't escalate. That, to me, is recognizing the dynamics of morphogenic change and trying to deal with it. Perspectivism. Perspectivism is another major tenet of feminist writing. It's, again, pointing out that the male perspective, which used to be the only perspective, and so therefore wasn't even seen as the male perspective, but was seen as universal, is now being seen as a particular perspective, and there are other perspectives, and here's one, here's another, here's another. Recognizing that reality is not single-faceted. Reality is something that depends on who's looking and how they're looking and what their lenses are, what their point of view is, what their history is, what their language is. There are limits to objectivity, to being able to describe an objective reality out there independently from the observer or the perspective. This came out in one of my talks earlier this week on quantum mechanics and physics. There is no such thing as a perspective-free view of reality, a point of view which is somehow high enough or detached enough to be fully objective and free of prejudice. In quantum physics, the observer is intrinsically, inescapably tied to what is being observed. They together make up a system, each influencing the other reciprocally. In relativistic physics, notions of time and space, which we think of as separate, here's space and time as what we're living in relativity those two ideas mingle, intermingle and mix, so that space and time become one conglomerate, space-time. And they look, that space-time looks different for different observers. If you're traveling at a different speed relative to somebody else, you see their clocks going slower, for example. If I'm going by you at 1,000 miles an hour, well, 100,000 miles an hour, 100,000 miles a second, it speeds near the speed of light, and I look at your physical processes, I will see your heartbeat being slower, I will see all the clocks on your little rocket ship running slower, and you look at me and you'll see the same thing. You'll see my processes going slower. What this does, and what's kind of scary about it, is when you say beyond objectivity or strict objectivity, it's tending to say everything's relative. And in a sense, I do want to say that. Everything depends on who's looking at it. But that doesn't mean that we have absolutely nothing to use as guidelines anymore. In particular, it turns out, amazingly, that we can agree on a lot of things. That wouldn't necessarily have to be the case. It turns out that there's an amazing overlap between our different views of reality. And it's in that overlap, that agreement, that communication that we can share, that you can define some kind of consensus reality that allows us to function as human beings. That's called a culture, it's called a linguistic group, it's called a community. Whenever you can sort of consent upon a reality and consent upon a language to use and have communication amongst the group, then you can work together and work cooperatively for some kind of higher enterprise. It's really neat. I see that as a gift of God that allows us to consent on reality. and allows this diversity of perspectives to come to agreement sometimes and take on common enterprises. Recognizing that metaphors and models and words for explaining the world do depend on value choices and on perceptual and linguistic prejudices suggests that rather than spending our energy on always trying to get above that, since it's inevitable, let's acknowledge it, spend our energy on making sure we're clear about our prejudices and our values, our assumptions, our biases, our lenses, our paradigms. And that's what typically feminist writers will do, as I mentioned last night. They'll point out at the very beginning of their writing what biases they're coming from, so you'll know when you read their stuff what their perspective is. I'd like to read this is from a book, an anthropology book that I used last year that was really exciting for me because so many of the ideas were tying in with ideas in physics. There can be no neutral, value-free starting point of analysis. The positivistic notion that there can be or should be is, aside from being poor philosophy and poor science, an ideological prejudice of itself. Here I am in an agreement with Joan Robinson, who says the following about value judgments in the social sciences. She points out that every human being has an ideological, moral, or political views. To deny these views, pretending not to have them, and claiming to be purely objective, she says, must, quote, necessarily be either self-deception or a device to deceive others. A candid writer will make his or her preconceptions clear and allow the reader to discount them if the reader does not accept them. This concerns the professional honor of the scientist. But to eliminate value judgments from the subject matter of social science is to eliminate the subject itself. For since it concerns human behavior, it must be concerned with the value judgments that people make. The social scientist, whatever he or she may privately believe, has no right to pretend to know any better than their neighbors what ends society should serve. The business of the social scientist is to show them why they believe what they purport to believe, as far as he or she can make out. So one of the perspectivism. Mutual causality I can treat real quickly because I've already alluded to it. It has to do with the fact that a lot of things in life don't cause each other. This doesn't cause this only, but this also causes this. It's part of what we were talking about with hierarchy. In hierarchies, we think of this causing this, causing this, causing this, and there's a chain of causality. You've heard that phrase probably. And we always look for, this happened. Why did that happen? Oh, because of this. Oh, why did that happen? Because of this. It's very deeply ingrained in our minds to try and establish linear causal relationships. And what happens is there are a lot of systems in this world that don't cause each other in a one-way track, but cause each other mutually. There's the word that's kind of in nowadays called coevolution. It suggests that it's part of the morphogenesis process that suggests that things don't evolve by this causing this, but things co-evolve. This causes this to change, and then when this changes, it causes this to change, and when this changes, it causes this to change, and you get this reciprocal, this interactive change processes that occur in nature. That's where, if you're trying to deal with a family that has a mental health problem, and you recognize that, I gave it away already, you try and deal with a person that has a mental health problem, you can't deal with them in the context of an isolated individual. You have to deal with them in the context of the family, and in a sense say, the family has a mental health problem. And very often, if you look into it, it turns out it's not the family's problem either. It's the context in which the family occurs, or the historical context in which the family occurs, that's the problem. And so you have to deal with the interactive forces that are going on there and treat the whole thing as an interactive system. It's not just that the person is sick because this, because this, because this. It's that that illness itself feeds back over here, and that feeds back here, and the whole thing becomes a vicious circle. And so you have to start looking at the reciprocal interactions. It occurs in ministry when you, if you go into a foreign country and you try to say, I'm going to bring you the gospel. Here's what the gospel is, folks. If you're not open to the reciprocal interaction in that process, if you're not open to change, you're going to be a very ineffective minister, I think. If you're not open to the culture that you're part of, if you don't see the language that they're using, if you're not ready to learn from them as well as teach, you're not going to be a very effective minister. If I'm not open to you all, if I'm just going to keep talking here and not give you some time, I'm not going to be a very effective teacher either, so better hurry up along through here. So mutual causality or feedback is typically the dynamic process responsible for frequently unforeseeable emergent behavior of complex systems. It's the cause of holism, holistic behavior, of synergy, where this energizes this, of bootstrapping, of morphogenesis that we talked about before, of threshold effects, of phase changes, goal-seeking, learning processes, consciousness. Okay, let's get on the holographic ordering. This is a whole big area, and I'm not going to try and get into it a whole lot, but holography is a big new area of physics. You've probably heard of the idea of holography or lasers. Holography wasn't really possible before we had lasers to give us light that had uniform frequency, where all the light is of almost exactly the same frequency. This allowed us to make a funny kind of photography, which we call holography. And holographies, holograms, are made without a lens. You would take a picture of, say, that pile of books. Here's my film. I'll shine laser light on it, let the light shine on the books, and let a reference light shine on my film. The light bounces off the books, hits the film, and exposes the film, but I have no lens here. Now, what you'd think, if you just put a piece of film out here and shine light all over it, you know, coming from all corners of that scene, coming from the laser itself directly, that there would just be a hodgepodge on this piece of film. And that's right, there is. It's a hodgepodge, it's a very particular hodgepodge that allows you to process that film, you develop it, you shine a laser light back through it, and you can reconstruct the image that was down there, but in a very strange way. You don't just get a picture of a pile of books. You get as though you have a window here now where my film was, looking at those books. So I can look up through this corner of the film and I can see the books from this direction. I can look from over here and I can see the books from that direction. From down here in my film, let's get down here, and I can see the books from down in this direction or over here from this direction. No matter where I look in my film, I see the books from the particular point of view of that particular little piece of film, because that film, that piece of film right in there, received the light coming from the books from that direction, and this piece received the image from this direction. And that's how a hologram gives you the three-dimensional effect that it has, because each part of the film sees the image from its particular perspective. That's how that idea ties in with this idea, that a holographic ordering is perspective dependent. Each part sees from its own point of view. And moreover, you can take this hologram and cut it into pieces. Each little piece of the film will give you a look at the whole object. You take a photograph of those books and you cut it into pieces, and one piece will see, you know, this little corner of this book, or this little corner of this book, or this little piece here. But if you take a hologram and chop it up, each little piece will let you see the whole thing as you look through it. So that's a nice metaphor for how each part contains information about the whole. You know, to be kind of corny about it, each person is a manifestation of God. Each of us is sort of, in a sense, represents all of humanity and represents God. Individual by individual, we're parts. It's not just that we have to come together to form the body of Christ. We are the body of Christ. But we're somehow not as complete in that representation as we could be if we came together. As you add more pieces into this hologram, you get a bigger perspective. You get a three-dimensional view. You get a more varied perspective on God or on the image that you're interested in. So no one of us has a complete view of God. No one of us has a complete view of the world or of what to do. But together, we put together a much more complete perspective. We also get better resolution. That's a technical term again for how, as you get smaller and smaller and smaller in this hologram, you finally get so the picture starts looking fuzzy. It just doesn't have very fine resolution. But as you take a larger piece of the holographic film, then the resolution becomes more clear. So you get a clearer and clearer, a sharper and sharper picture the more you get. So I definitely have that feeling. I mean, it's the old statement, two heads are better than one. It's when you put together several people and you have an interaction, you can get a better feeling that you understand what's going on than when you just try and do it yourself. And then finally, let me read a little bit of that. Do I have time? No. I'll skip that. Finally, I want to talk about indeterminacy. This was a very cardinal principle in quantum physics. In 1927, Werner Heisenberg proposed his uncertainty principle, which is actually kind of mislabeled. It's not uncertainty, it's actually indeterminacy. It states that there is an absolute limit in nature to the precision with which one may simultaneously determine the position and the momentum of an object. And moreover, the fact that this limit exists leads to observable consequences in nature. In other words, it's not just a limit on how well we can do an experiment, it's actually a limit that nature itself recognizes. It involves a universal constant of nature called Planck's constant. There's other such intrinsic indeterminacy in other fields as well. There was the former preoccupation that we had with trying to specify boundaries or precise definitions of things. We now recognize that, you know, to define something, you can only define a word in its context. The meaning of a word is not some abstract dictionary definition. The meaning of the word is all the usages that that word has been called upon to do, to make. So it's defined relationally. In that sense, then the word doesn't have a boundary. You can't put it in a box and say, this is what the word means. The word is defined by the totality of its usages, the relationships it has. Or a person, try and define who you are without mentioning anybody else. Or mentioning what you do or what your function is, the way you interact with your environment. And it's sort of meaningless. People are defined by their relationships to Earth and to each other. So you can't draw boundaries, rigid boundaries. So that's part of what that indeterminacy means to me. There's an emphasis then on quality over quantity, beyond analysis to intuition, beyond science to aesthetics, beyond know-how to know-why, beyond materialism to idealism, beyond atomism to holism, beyond self to community, beyond nationalism to human family, beyond a theology of certitude or a theology of glory to a theology of the cross, which involves ambiguities and uncertainties. Again, from this anthropologist, there's a tribe in Northern California of Indians, Native Americans, called the Wintu. And Wintu boundaries tend to be very vague. One area of their territory tends to phase into another. The Wintu never assert something as absolutely true as we do when we say it is. In every utterance that the Wintu makes, the speaker must indicate, by the use of suffixes in their language, how he or she came to know or infer the truth of that statement. Thus, as an English speaker would have to indicate number and tense, with each of our words. The Wintu speaker is obliged by the grammar to indicate the source of knowledge, of which there are five distinct types. And here's an example. In one of the common stories about the German, the Frenchman, and the Englishman, the first two, pointing to bread, say, "I call it brot," or "I call it pain." But the Englishman says, "I call it bread, and it is bread." That story could have been dealing with American, I think, but I think we get our tendency to do that maybe from our English heritage. But there's a real tendency to say, to really feel like, you know, not only do I call this bread, it is bread. But we forget that bread is just the word we attach to it. The Wintu never say, "It is bread." They would say, "It looks to me bread," "It feels to me bread," or "I have heard it to be bread," or "I infer from the evidence that it be bread," or "I think it to be bread," or "According to my experience, be bread." So there's a real sense of recognition of the limits of human abilities to categorize and separate and identify and cling to absolutes. And I think that must be some benefits in their society from that. It is a peaceful, it was a peaceful tribe. Okay, got through the pile. Do we have time for discussion? 3 minutes? Yeah.
What do you see as the relationship between perspectivism and holographic literature?
It was that within a holographic thing, each part of the hologram sees its from its perspective. And so there's a sense that each of us, through our own eyes, sees something different.